Shrink Wrap Radio number 757, The Power of Narrative Therapy, with Hugh K. Marr, PhD.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is clinical psychologist Hugh K. Marr. He is the author of A Clinician's Guide to Foundational Story Psychotherapy, Co-Changing Narratives, Co-Changing Lives. In addition, he consults to other professionals and healthcare agencies in the fields of psychotherapy and substance abuse. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Hugh Marr, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It is such a pleasure to meet you.
Well, it's my pleasure indeed. In fact, you reached out to me and let me know that you've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for a number of years.
Oh, many years. Probably since early on in your show. I had a what would otherwise have been a horrible commute, and listening to Shrink Wrap Radio made the commute not only tolerable, but probably kept me awake and saved my life on occasion.
Oh, all right. Good. That's a new accomplishment here that I wasn't aware of. And so we're going to be talking about story and narrative therapy. And you've written this really wonderful book here. I'm going to try to hold it up. I don't know how, whether it comes into focus or not, but just so that people got an idea of what it looks like. And it's barely more than 200 pages. And the title is A Clinician's Guide to Foundational Story Psychotherapy, Co-Changing Narratives, Co-Changing Lives. And I point out that it's barely more than 200 pages because I come away from it with a feeling that this is a really encyclopedic book in some ways. Is you've touched on so much. It's such a tour de force. And so much history and theory and practical advice is woven into it to just make it a very authoritative and mind expanding book. So I congratulate you on accomplishing all of that.
And I so appreciate that. It's been a culmination of kind of pulling together many, many interests over many, many years.
So yeah.
It was mostly a delight to write it.
Oh, well that's good. that helps.
Yes.
I forgot what I was going to say specifically here, but I think it's a – oh, I had a fresh sort of insight as I was thinking about, you know, what I might say in praise of the book. And I had what for me was kind of a fresh realization that story seems to cross-cut all of human activity.
Yes.
All of human activity, even history, philosophy, religion, entertainment, And so it's so to be able to talk about it in a way that's coherent and doesn't do violence to any of that, and in fact enhances all of that, that's really quite an accomplishment. So,
we are such we're such narrative creatures that that we don't even realize, you know, we kind of swim in story.
So we don't
realize the story goes through so much of all of our accomplishments and our endeavors. It's kind of like Sherlock Holmes had talked about the best place to hide something is in plain sight, right?
Yeah.
Story is like right there in plain sight, but we have generally ignored that and not really studied it like it deserves.
I've just been reading a book called The Plague Year, and it's a really well-written book by, I think his name is Richard Wright. I may not have that perfectly right, but he observed, during the COVID, he sat in on a lot of the committee hearings and read transcripts and so on following that whole series of events. And something that very interesting that he reported was that the congressional committees of decision makers, they did not respond terribly well to all the facts that were being recited, to the graphs and the charts and so on. What they had to do was to call in people, witnesses who would tell their stories.
Yes.
And I realize that that's often how Congress has worked around a whole lot of issues. They don't take it seriously until they hear some stories that really bring it home that they can relate to.
That's exactly right. We're so oriented to narrative.
Yeah. So in your book, you go into the history of story and some of the giants on whose shoulders we stand in relation to story. But I'd like to jump ahead, because we have only so much time here, to narrative therapy and the work of Michael White, if we could start there.
Sure.
So take us through his approach in terms of the assumptions and practices and so on.
Sure. And I'll say that Michael White is certainly one of the giants that I feel like really informed how I understand things. But I'm not a narrative therapist in the tradition of Michael White. White was probably one of the most celebrated, if not one of the first, to really take a narrative approach, originally to family therapy, but then he applied what he did to individuals. He applied it to indigenous tribes in Australia. He consulted with organizations and businesses and really, really had a very, very broad application. And he developed almost a whole other language to describe what it was he was doing. And he believed that people have a shared story that oftentimes our clients, in one way or another, are left out of, and that causes much of the angst that people experience. Mm. And so, a lot of what he helped people do was to restory, to take their own narrative and to find bits and pieces of it that could be put together into a new narrative that would be much more hopeful and functional. He also had a really, I'd have to say, he wouldn't use this word probably, but a very political or politicized agenda, in that he very much believed that people, especially mental health clients, often were underdogs in society. Again, not his work, but and he believed that including everyone and their story was so important. And he really took that as a very almost radical political way of being. And he very, very tragically died as a relatively young man. I don't think he was quite 60 years old, if I remember. He was doing a conference in San Diego, and he had a heart attack.
Now you mentioned that you have not primarily modeled your approach to psychotherapy and narrative around him, and you mentioned another person who I suspect would be the important one for you, Don McAdams. Would that be right? And I was wondering to what extent his ideas have taken hold in the trenches, because Michael White's the one I've heard of, and I'd never heard of McAdams.
Exactly. Well, and part of that is McAdams is a researcher. So he's not a clinician, and he's a psychologist in Chicago, and he and his students research life stories and the impact of story and the narrative way that we view the world. And so that's probably why, clinicians are not as familiar with McAdams. But his protocol for the way that he questions people about their stories would do any clinician proud in terms of a way of understanding how a client came by who she is at the current time. Just very nicely done. And he pulls together a lot of the research on narrative in his own work.
Okay. Now, one of the things that you confront in the book is we say story, we say narrative as if we know what those things are. And it can get very complicated as you try to parse, what are the boundaries of it? What are the elements and so on? Now, in one place here in the book, you list eight elements, and I don't think we need to go into them in detail because I think they are pretty self-explanatory. You list author, voice/narrative, context, character and roles, plot, theme, moral or lesson, overall or meta characteristics of the story. Now, your book is about what you call the foundational story, which sounds like, okay, this is kind of a meta view, maybe, of story. And I'm going to ask you, in less than book length, to define what you mean by foundational story.
Sure. So all of us, beginning in late adolescence, most all of us, have a life story. And that story really helps determine how we see ourselves, how we relate to other people, and how we understand the world. Part of that narrative, part of that life story narrative, we're very familiar with, and we're conversant with it. Part of it, for many of us, is enacted, but not necessarily all put into words. But nevertheless, in late adolescence, beginning then, we can reflect on our past and look toward our future, and we can tie those together with a story of our life. Before that time, before late adolescence, children are not so able to do that. Now, they understand the concept of story for sure, and they understand being a protagonist, an agent. They understand intent, and they remember events from the past. But to be able to link that in a flow from the past, moving toward the future, and have it as something that defines me, that only occurs in early adulthood.
Okay, so the idea of a foundational story, what I'm taking that to mean now is that we might each have some kind of a story that, an overall story that we feel kind of guides characterizes who we are.
Yeah.
And of course, what we know from other branches of therapy is that to some extent, a lot of that may be unconscious, right?
Yeah.
That the story that we have adopted and are trying to live out maybe was inherited from our parents or family or cultural influences.
Exactly. That's where it gets into the idea of foundational story, because our life story is primarily made up of vignettes of experiences that we've had and our take on those experiences. Those are the foundational stories. And those stories, those happenings in our lives really ultimately shape our life story, but also our life story shapes what becomes a foundational story. You know, in any day, all of us have thousands of events, some of them monumental, but most of them very minor. And this happens day after day after day.
Yeah.
And we remember only a minuscule part of them.
Right?
The ones that we select that get remembered, by and large, are ones that fit in with our life story. Uh-huh. So that the life story helps determine the vignettes that are foundational. And some happenings are so influential that they actually impact our life story. And so it works in that direction as well. So that's the connection.
Yeah, to the extent that we have a personality, there's another interesting construct, right?
Yes.
To the extent that we have a personality is probably related to our having a sense of a coherent story. And
yes.
that coherence that either is built in or that comes to pass with time sort of becomes a big part of our personality.
Exactly. And so a lot of people with what we call disorders of personality, a big piece of that has to do with a lack of coherence in their life narrative.
Yeah, yeah. And so a big part of the therapy, of working with things therapeutically then, is the notion that a person can change their story. They can tell themselves a different story, which might be bordering on behavior therapy, right? Mm-hmm. Some forms of behavior therapy tell a different story.
Very much.
And that we can change our story and write a different, so to speak, write a different narrative for ourselves.
Yes.
And that idea and its broad outline like that, really, there's probably no therapy that doesn't fit.
That's exactly right. One of the things in a long career, I was very interested in a number of different approaches to therapy, beginning in the early 70s with you probably remember National Training Labs, NTL.
Yep. NTL, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So I worked with Leland Bradford from there, and I went on and a wonderful job after my first round of graduate school that was very family therapy oriented, and they had a lot of structural and strategic family therapy trainings. Then I at that time had supervision with Rabbi Ed Friedman, Friedman's Fables, and he was a Bowenian, and so he looked at family therapy from Bowen's perspective, and that was very attractive to me. And then I took a job as director of emergency services for a mental health center in Washington, D.C., which was really a training program for psychiatric residents and psychology interns. And there, that was very psychodynamically oriented. And I had a couple of years of individual supervision with an analyst. I presented a year-long case to another analyst and became very involved there. When the Mental Health Center unfortunately was reorganized and essentially folded, I took another job and entered a Jungian analysis. I have all of these different threads, but unlike some of my colleagues, I never felt comfortable just totally committing to one psychotherapy.
Yeah, me either.
So because there is as rich as an approach is, and for me, I think a Jungian understanding is probably the biggest tent for me. But even there, other approaches have so much else to say.
Yeah,
and I always had this sense there's got to be a way that these different understandings fit together and came about.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so that's a long way of saying I very much agree with what you say, that story integrates virtually all psychotherapies.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, even I was thinking when the kids come home from school, you know, we say, tell me about your day.
You're lucky
if you get anything. They'll tell you a little mini narrative, or your spouse, you know, will say, tell me about your day. And so we've got those stories, those little stories, and they may have points of conflict and so on, you know, characteristics of stories that you point out. Often there's an antagonist or a problem that needs to be confronted and overcome.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned that another source of stories, that we get prompted for stories by fairy tales and dreams. So, you know, Jungian work and psychoanalytic work often, dreaming can play a very important role. And depending upon how strongly the practitioner is oriented in that direction, how much energy they'll put into it. How about yourself? Do you have a favorite fairy tale from some point in your life that you think maybe tells an important part of your own story?
Oh, what a wonderful question.
I should have primed you ahead of time for that.
No, that's fine. It's much better like this. Let me think. Yeah. And I think it points to some of the struggles in my own story, as do the fairy tales that stick with many children. So for me, it was Hansel and Gretel.
Okay.
Right? And in the tale, I had it. It was given to me by my parents on an old 78 RPM record, right? A telling of the story.
Yeah.
And I put that record as a small child on the shelf in my closet. And I was afraid to go in the closet because that record was in the closet.
Right? Wow. Yeah.
And so, you know,
might be a witch in there.
Exactly. So better to avoid that closet. Right. And it is a story, obviously the stepmother, which in fairy tales was by and large a way of being euphemistic about speaking about the mother.
Yeah.
in many fairy tales. So
the bad mother, as an analysis,
that's right.
The bad mother, yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so you kind of project it onto this other woman, this stepmother, who wants to deal with the family poverty by getting rid of the children. And she sends them into the woods, where, of course, they find the house of gingerbread that the witch owns. And the witch is probably just another incarnation of the stepmother. It's not directly said in the story, but that's quite likely. The children are put in a cage, right? And fattened.
Right. Yeah. And they put out a little chicken bone to.
Right. right. And then, the idea is that the children will be eaten. So they each try to come up with, what to do, but actually it's Gretel, who ends up when the witch, opens the oven, that ends up pushing the witch into the oven. So it's Gretel that really saves her brother Hansel.
Yeah.
So in a sense, what they have, overcome, is this part, parts are both internal and external. They reflect each other, the internal and the external. And it's this part that wants to, subsume them, that could take over, take over their lives in a way that would be, disastrous for them.
Okay.
That they would really lose their own life if it were taken over. And they prevail, with, ingenuity and with persistence and with collaboration.
Uh-huh.
Between
yeah.
the male and the female. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So while that was not my favorite story, it was the most impactful fairy tale for me.
Uh-huh.
So fairy tales are, especially the ones that grab us as children, they are in their own right a foundational story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I've got one myself. Yeah. For me, it's called The Tinder Box, and I won't go into all the detail of it, but there is it starts off with a swashbuckling soldier and, who's kind of waylaid by a witch and goes underground and finds these magical dogs sitting on treasure, and he's given a way to, trick the dogs and so on. And then he later has a wild life spending all the treasure that he's found and ends up in a prison. And he sees through the prison window a parade going by and this beautiful woman who he instantly falls in love with, only to find out that it's the princess, and he has to figure out a way to get the princess. And so that story just stuck with me. And as I looked at it and thought about it, why is this story so important to me? And it was, again, the idea of ingenuity, of being a bit of a trickster and figuring out how to kill the witch and how to get the treasure and how to fool the princess's king and queen.
Yeah.
and win the princess and get out of prison and all of that.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways I modeled myself at some level on this sort of heroic vision, that I wanted to be a hero, that I would be a hero, a risk taker and be clever. So I think that's been sort of an important story to me.
Sure. And perhaps that ingenuity would free you.
Yeah. Would do what?
Ingenuity.
Yeah. Would what?
Would free you and grant you a goal?
Yeah, right. And And also, you know, so we've mentioned fairy tales, movies, a favorite movie sometimes will have a big impact on a person, and they may try to model certain of their parts of their character on a hero that they've seen in a movie.
Yes.
So one of the things that all of this puts me in mind of in the idea of changing your story is dream work approaches. That urge dreaming the dream on, what they call dreaming the dream on, or re-scripting the ending to have a more satisfying conclusion.
Yes.
And now your book has details, a lot of recommendations to the reader to help them identify their stories and to suggest ideas for how they might work with their stories. Well, I wonder if there are clinical examples that you can share with us, about ways that you've used story, if a clinical case or two come to mind, and sort of what the presenting problem was and how story entered into it and so on.
Sure. So, I'll preface it by saying that virtually all therapies, sort of what we touched on before, if they're successful for a person, they ultimately help them change their story.
Okay. Well.
And different therapies apply to different elements of a story. So, for example, many of the humanistic therapies really have to do with the witness to the story and the process of the therapist as witness. So it's the context, the witness as the context to the story, and having a witness who is involved, caring, and yet objective enough to not be totally caught up in the story. It's a very different experience for many people than anything they've encountered in their lives.
Yes.
So
it's a wonderful thing to have your story listened to at a deep level and to have it cared for.
Yes.
And to And having it cared for, both not only do you feel kind of loved in that process, but also can begin to adopt that stance for yourself to care for yourself and for your story.
That's exactly right. So it's really the witnessing changes the context of the story.
Yeah.
So therapies that emphasize that really change the context. Other therapies, I think of Jeffrey Young, the CBT therapist. I guess he would be in that camp, but he works with schemas.
Yes,
and helps people identify and modify their schemas. Well, that's the theme of their story, the problematic theme, and so he's helping them change that theme in their story. So different therapies change different aspects of a story. And as long as the client, as it fits for the client, it doesn't matter what aspect, what element of a story is changed, because changing any element changes the story. Right? So one of the first clients that I had really begun to think about this with was at the time, this is some years ago, 16-year-old boy, referred by his parents because of marijuana. They were very concerned, and they were very anti any drugs, and they were very, very concerned that their son was not only using, but he would leave paraphernalia around in his room. And, you know, when they would go through his room, they would find, you know, pipes, or they'd find, you know, marijuana leaves.
Right.
And they would be very upset with him and upset about him, and they would put him on restriction for, you know, a long, long time. And as a result of the restriction, the young man would become depressed. So the parents had taken him to a psychiatrist who prescribed an antidepressant. When the young man got through a bout of depression, immediately he would go out with his friends and use marijuana. So it was, the plot was a cycle here of essentially crime and guilt and punishment. So he uses marijuana, and that leads to his guilt. And so he sets himself up to be punished. He leaves the paraphernalia out, and he could have hidden it.
Yeah, right.
He didn't do that. And so he gets punished. That leads to his depression, and he feels very alienated when he's depressed. The way he described his depression, his type of depression, was a real alienation. The cure for that turned out to be marijuana use, because I asked him, so tell me about your smoking weed. Where do you do it? Who do you do it with? And what is the experience like for you? And this 16-year-old boy, he surprised me. He got quiet for a minute, and he said, well, Doc, you're kind of not going to believe this, I don't think. It's kind of spiritual. And I said, what do you mean?
Interesting. Yeah.
He said, I always use it with my buddies. I never smoke by myself. And when I do that, we feel so connected. So that's the piece. You know, the alienation of the depression is resolved by the connection that comes through using the marijuana. And that sets the whole plot in motion again.
Yeah.
And it cycled in a very, what's called in narrative, hamartic, which is a very tragic way. What happened to this young man, he and his buddies decided to get together at this one young man's house when the young man's parents were going to be out of town. And the parents were going to leave this other 16-year-old at home. And, of course, that was the reason for a big pot party.
Yeah.
The parents, at the last minute, thought better of it and so told their son that he had to go with them. He had to go out of town with them. But that didn't deter my client and his other buddies. They knew there was nobody home at this house. And they had a great rec room, and it was a wonderful place to party and smoke more weed. So they slipped in the basement window that they knew was open and went in and, you know, brought their pipes and, you know, brought their music. And, of course, the woman next door is kind of the neighborhood watch lady.
Yeah.
She's looking out the window, and she sees all of these young men, she thought, climbing through the window of this house that she knew the people were
with. Oh, boy, yeah.
So she calls the police, who in their wisdom, instead of sending a couple of patrolmen to check, they sent the SWAT team.
Oh, great.
The SWAT team surrounds the house, right, and gets on the bullhorn and says, you know, come out with your hands up. Everybody clear the house now. So my client's friends, of course, were terrified, and they all came out with their hands up. My client was so scared. Instead of coming out, he ran and hid in a closet. So after these other young people came out, the SWAT team sent in the dogs. And by the time they got there, the dogs had bitten through his leg to the bone and had torn an ear.
Oh.
So
Talk about a bad trip.
Right. Wow. Right. So you can see how the same pattern of punishment for this experience of connection that he got through weed was escalated, 1,000%.
Yeah.
To this incredible punishment, which was horrendous. But for this young man actually going through and diagramming the plot that he lived out with him, helped him see that. And then we worked together to figure out other ways that he could feel that kind of spiritual connection without using marijuana with his friends.
Yeah.
He had plastic surgery on his ear. And when I last heard from him, he was close to graduating from college and had done quite well. So that's an example of a tragic, plot, that by working with the plot allowed the young man to take his insight, or as Aristotle calls recognition, and then find a way to apply it, so that he didn't need to repeat the cycle in the same way.
Wow, that's quite a story. It's a scary story because I'm remembering myself in graduate school, when at the time, early psychedelic days, and I did take LSD and other psychedelics, but there was always that lingering fear of something like that happening.
Right.
Fortunately, that never happened. I lucked out.
Yes. It's obviously extremely rare, but you were right to be afraid.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting that whole thing has progressed to the point where it has now, where, there's serious consideration looking into psychedelics as assisting healing.
Yes.
And, of course, story is a very important part of that, too.
They
come to look at their story in a different way as a result, and to be able to tolerate the anxiety that looking frankly at their story tends to generate, that the psychedelics can make that easier to tolerate. So I'm going to take a big jump ahead here because of the story that you shared, because the book towards the end goes pretty seriously into trauma.
Yes.
And so talk to us about the role of story, of narrative, in trauma work.
Sure. Well, it's crucial because trauma, you can think of trauma as a particular foundational story, right? So trauma changes one's life story. It alters the course of one's life story. I think it was Judith Herman who put it so well. She was a psychiatrist who in the 1990s was one of the first to really talk about the broad impact of trauma. And she said, when people undergo trauma, they end up feeling like they're a damaged person in a dangerous world.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's the kind of plot line that comes about often as a result of trauma. So it impacts the life story. But then the traumatic event itself is a story. It's a foundational story with some real problems with it. And it's similar in a way to a nightmare. A nightmare is not just an anxious dream. It's an anxious dream with no ending. You're running and you run toward the cliff and you slip and you fall over the cliff. You don't hit the bottom in the nightmare.
Right.
It ends where you fall off. there's no ending to it.
Yeah.
So too with trauma stories, there's no ending to it. It keeps going, and it places in the story or in the event as it happens, in order to protect our deepest sense of self, we really go offline in a sense. And we don't track in the same way what's going on around us. And even more than that, we often go into an altered state that can really be much like any altered state you could experience in a drug trip. You know, people in bad car accidents often talk about the experience of being up above the accident and watching the cars move in slow motion. You know, that's an altered state, right?
Yeah.
So the foundational story of the trauma event has gaps in it where we've gone offline, and also places where we've entered it with an altered state. So it's an incomplete story with these gaps that become, means that the pieces of the story that we do remember are almost like psychic shards. And they're divorced one from another. So sometimes, for example, a pain that occurred as a result of being, you know, I don't know, in a wreck or being beaten or whatever in a traumatic event, that pain occurs in the body with no context. You just feel the pain and you don't know why. And so, you know, you go to umpteen medical doctors, and in many cases, there's no physical explanation for whatever the pain is. It's one of those shards of the story. It's the feeling shard that's disconnected from the rest of the trauma story.
Yeah. So what is the therapeutic option?
So the therapeutic option, which is done in different ways with most trauma therapies, is to make that story of the trauma a complete story with no gaps, and to put an ending to it. So as with a gap in a story, it's like we really strive for psychic completeness in a very elemental way. And when we have a story that's important to us that doesn't make sense because there's a gap, that we keep going back to it, like picking at a scab. And that's a big part of the repetition.
Right.
Comes in trauma. So I can think of an example. You have time for a clinical example?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. This fellow some years ago called me up and he said, I have a marital problem. I'd like to come see you. And I said, fine, let's schedule a time for you and your wife to come in. He said, no, I don't want my wife to come because it's not her problem. It's mine. And I said, well, you know, in marital therapy, it's usually best if both partners come, but let's meet one time and talk about it and see what this is about. So he came in. And it turns out the marital problem was his wife would go to bed at about 10 o'clock every night. He would go to bed about 3 in the morning. And I said, so what are you doing between 10 at night and 3 in the morning? Well, he lived in a large house. And what he was doing was he would go to every window and unlock it, open it, close it, relock it, every door, open, close, relock. He would go around the house 3 times. It's a big house before he could go to bed. His wife was apoplectic. She said she felt that he didn't love her anymore. He wouldn't even go to bed with her, right? And you know, and he was going through his day so tired that he was unavailable in so many ways.
Huh. Wow. It sounds like a very unusual kind of case of OCD.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Which can often, like all mental health symptoms, can result from trauma and the problem with the trauma story. Turns out this guy was a Vietnam vet. He was a helicopter pilot.
Oh, my goodness.
Uh-huh. His job, when they would come into these base camps out in the jungle, he was the pilot that was chosen to go around all the choppers and make sure they were all moored down correctly before he could then go back into camp. So he's still securing the choppers.
Yeah.
Only, you know, it's 25 years later.
Wow.
And it's getting in the way of his life.
Yeah.
So it gives you a sense of how this story and this intent in the story of protecting the child.
Had he made that connection prior to seeing you?
No, not at all.
Wow.
Not at all.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah, that's very dramatic.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So trauma is, and the influence of trauma on story is what makes trauma gives it the huge impact, either a causal link or an associative link to every substance abuse and mental health issue.
Yeah, so... Now, who's the ideal reader for this book?
Well, the ideal reader is probably a clinician. I'm happy, of course, if everyone would read it, but it's really written for the clinician.
Yeah.
Of any persuasion, because my hope is. One, to write a book that would be accessible, that people would enjoy reading, and yet would give them some depth in doing that, and would help them understand how story is used in their own method of therapy, and would open them up a bit to other therapies and how they might approach things so they can expand their own way of working.
Yes, yes. And that's certainly the message that I got from the book, and so you're feeling that clinicians of any persuasion could really make use of deepening their understanding of story and some of the therapeutic options that would be available to them.
Whether you're attachment oriented or cognitive behavioral, or whether you work with primarily victims of abuse, or whether you work with substance problems, or whether you work in an organization or privately, you know, the whole range. Story is the backdrop for all of us.
Yeah. Have you done any workshops on this? It seems like it would be. You know, a lot of times people go to workshops to get new arrows in their quiver, and it seems like this might be a prime opportunity for you to spread your sense of this work.
Yes, yes, thank you. Yes, indeed. So actually I have a workshop coming up on the 14th of this month through the SASE Institute. Are you familiar with SASE?
It sounds familiar. What does it stand for? It
stands for the Substance Abuse Subtle Screening Inventory.
No, I'm not familiar with that.
Okay. It's a very clever screening instrument for understanding to what extent a person might have a problem with substance use without their having to know or acknowledge that they have a problem with substances.
Hmm.
And I had done trainings for them because I had I'd used that first with the partial hospital program that I directed for many years, and then in private practice I see a lot of clients with substance problems. And And so Sanasi is beginning to move into doing trainings, CEU trainings.
Yeah.
And they're just moving into that actually this year, and they ask if I would do training. So the first one is on the 14th of this month, and there'll be others. And I also will start doing trainings through other organizations. I've done a number of trainings in the Washington area for groups of clinicians, but I am hoping to do more widespread trainings.
Would I be right to assume that that narrative work will creep into that training?
Yes, not only creep in.
Be very explicitly.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. There yeah. will be the focus. Because it's the focus of what we do, all of us, you know, whether we recognize it or not.
Yeah. Yeah, that's. I'm glad to hear that that's available. This was, listeners may think that this was a put up thing for me to ask you about workshops, but it wasn't. I didn't know that you were doing that. But it to me seems like a logical and a needed extension of your work. So I really wish you
more and more of that.
Yeah, yeah. So I really wish you good success with that. So this probably is a place where we should wrap it up for today. There's so much more, as I hinted in the book, so many more directions that we could take out in. Is there anything that you didn't get to say that you sort of hoped was going to come out?
Yes. You mean what my hope for the book?
No, in terms of our interview, if there was something that you'd hope to cover that didn't really come up in the interview.
Oh, well, as you say, there are a lot of details and a lot of ways of approaching story that are delineated in the book. But I think what I would hope would come out is that we're all embedded in stories. And we all, as adults, have a life story. And our clients, by and large, come to us with tragic stories. And they're hoping to turn tragic stories into redemptive stories. Mm-hmm. And so the more we understand about ways to impact story, and the more effective we can be as clinicians.
Well, I think that's a great wrap-up for our interview today. And so, Hugh Marr, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio. Good to have you on the other side of the speaker, so to speak. Not just as a listener, but as a talker.
Yes, indeed. Well, thank you so much. And it is such a pleasure to speak with you and to finally get to meet you.
Likewise. According to Scripture, in the beginning was the Word. I have to believe that close on the heels of the Word was the story. In fact, that passage is the beginning of an origin story. My interview with Dr. Hugh K. Marr puts me in touch with how deeply story defines our humanity. In fact, would it be too large a stretch to say that human beings are the storytelling species? Or should it be the story experiencing species? Human consciousness and story seem uniquely bound together. In fact, I've come to think of story or myth as a kind of exoskeleton that's part of the inborn survival package we come into this world with. Story and meaning are intimately linked. Our stories give us the meaning we crave almost as much as the air we breathe. Stories tell us who we are as individuals, as family members, as members of the tribe, and members of the nation. Those meanings are the glue that makes cooperation and survival possible for us. I'm thinking that the archetypes in our deep unconscious are both generators and receptors of story memes. We know that human individuals become sick or dysfunctional when they lose their story. And we've seen that human groups, tribes, societies fall apart when they lose their story, when it loses its juice, the meaning it once contained. Within this very broad appreciation for the universal significance of story, narrative therapy not only makes sense, but would also appear to be a bedrock necessity. And thus we find story in most, if not every, psychotherapy out there, from shamanistic to psychoanalytic to Jungian to cognitive behavioral and beyond. Here's a quote from Dr. Marr's book. Quote, "In sum, our very notion of self is a lived story. Our life story consists of chapters, which in turn contain remembered vignettes," close quote. His exploration of what he calls the foundational story is not to create yet another brand of psychotherapy, but to sharpen our awareness and skillfulness in shaping narrative regardless of theoretical orientation. He writes, and I quote, "The foundational story lens does not create a new approach to psychotherapy, although it does offer some new tools and techniques. Rather, it provides a context for understanding and utilizing many extant approaches. This narrative understanding is easily integrated into a therapist's given approach while broadening the clinician's awareness and acceptance of other techniques and theories," close quote. In their simplest form, he writes, quote, "Each of those stories at every level consists of the same elements, external and internal context, characters, minimally including a protagonist and an antagonist, a plot which is a problem, and its intended solution across time, a theme, and a moral," close quote. In the book, you'll find various exercises and prompts to get in touch with your own foundational story and tips on how to change it. Your own personal work will give you a better sense of how to help others perceive their own stories and revise them. And, of course, it's most likely not going to be one and done. Life is long and complex with many challenges and multiple nested stories. It's stories all the way down. In my opinion, Dr. Marr's book is a real tour de force. It's almost encyclopedic in its scope and yet barely more than 200 pages long. There are many practical tools as well. For example, there are 4 appendices, including a foundational story interview template, a foundational story diagram form, a family of origin mapping procedure, and a trauma list. Once again, the book is A Clinician's Guide to Foundational Story Psychotherapy, Co-Changing Narratives, Co-Changing Lives, by Hugh K. Marr, PhD.
Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for a while, so I thought it was high time for me to make a donation, for a couple of reasons. First of all, you've pointed me in the direction of some very interesting authors, whose books I have bought and obviously paid for, so I figured it was only fair that you get a reward for your own work. And secondly, these long, in-depth interviews are sort of a niche format, produced almost exclusively by independent podcasters who rely on individual donations to cover their own costs. So I'd like to appeal to all your listeners to step up to the plate and make a donation. Thank you very much for all your good work.
Thank you, Michael Ginter, for the recognition and appreciation. You nailed it. And thanks to all of our regular longtime donors. It warms my heart each time I'm looking at the honor roll on our site and am reminded of your dedication to keeping me going. And thanks to Angela Krause, our newest annual donor. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Big thanks go out to today's guest, clinical psychologist Hugh K. Marr, discussing his book, A Clinician's Guide to Foundational Story Psychotherapy. It was a real bonding experience. Next week's guests will be Mark O'Connell, New York City therapist, actor, and author of The Performing Art of Therapy, and actress Robin Weigert, who, among her film credits, is her role as the psychotherapist in the TV series Big Little Lies. This interview, synchronistically, is a perfect follow-on for today's episode on narrative therapy. So until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves and others.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.